50 lectures, and these lectures will be in particular quantum gravity, and quantum geometry. And so to first say something organizational, there is a script which I will distribute at some point. It sometimes evolves a bit. and I will basically more or less follow the script. There's more material even in the script than I managed to lecture here. and then there's several background reading you can do. There's a basic book called The First Course on Quantum Gravity, I guess on loop quantum gravity, by Gambini and Pullin, which starts, if I remember correctly, with special relativity. So there's this, lots of basic stuff covered, and it has basically explains the key ideas. And a bit more on an advanced level, the lecture notes by Alejandro Perez. These are GRQC from 2004. And there are several reviews you can read, so as you can guess, it means I will cover loop quantum gravity mostly. That's to give you basically one complete framework, as we will see, at least in 2+1. Most of these techniques are, however, very general. So I will cover basically systems with gauge degrees of freedom, constraints, and so on. And these are just general physics, including basically topological quantum field theories. So the approach I will follow here starts really from this idea that we should have learned, I hope, in the course by Hoos, that gravity is a property of space-time. And is in fact encoded in the curvature of space-time. So that means if you want to know what is a quantum theory of gravity, quantum gravity, we should actually figure out what is quantum space-time. And I find this aspect the most fascinating one, because it means you replace classical space-time, which we basically base so far more or less all physics on, with something which is a quantum space-time, and there are basically hundreds of different suggestions what this could be. But the question is, can you really come up with a consistent framework to specify what is the meaning of quantum space-time? And if you really, after this question, so it's a very ambitious question, it also hints that maybe you should try something like a non-perturbative approach, which unfortunately makes your life quite hard. Because, of course, if you can calculate that, then usually it is due to perturbation theory. Here, non-perturbative approach means, you know, opposite to a perturbative approach, that one doesn't assume a classical background, because we would have a classical background, we again would have a classical background space-time, and we could probably deduce what do the quantum fluctuations with this background space-time, but the expectation is that they're really non-perturbative effects which are relevant here. And of course, space-time means geometry, so we have to care about a theory of quantum geometry. And that's where we actually do have something like a complete framework to describe quantum geometry. So you can ask why quantum gravity. People do that sometimes. And yeah, so you can still try to avoid quantization of quantum gravity. So the reasons are mostly not so much provided by experiments, but by inconsistency. If you have quantum matter and try to couple it to gravity, so far all attempts have basically been failed to do that consistently. And I'm not going to describe all these attempts. If somebody is interested, can provide references. Apart from that, there are all these questions which came up also again in the recent years, which tell you that gravity in itself might be incomplete and which resolve around singularities, Big Bang singularities, black hole singularities, and firewalls, which indeed come more from a description of gravity as on a classical background, which is a black hole geometry. So that's basically the motivation. Let me give you a bit of overview. So I just have 3 weeks to teach you a bit about quantum gravity. And for this reason, I want to avoid lengthy calculations. And that is best done by concentrating on 3D gravity. So that means gravity in a 3D space-time. Without a cosmological constant, we're actually including a cosmological constant. We know how to do that. And Euclidean signature. Again, we in principle know how to do Lorentzian gravity and also to solve it. However, technically, it's much simpler to discuss Euclidean signature. Most of the stuff I will go through is actually also relevant for 4D. I mean, we will need that for 4D. Gravity. And I will usually point out if something is specific to 3D gravity and if something is not specific to 3D gravity. And 3D gravity in one aspect is very different from 4D gravity because it's so-called topological quantum field theory. And that actually allows us to basically completely solve the theory. And the problem is if you want to say something for quantum gravity, it's hard to do that without completely solving the theory. That makes quantum gravity a bit harder. And we will see so why this is the case in the course of the lectures. And that will be basically the overview. I hope you know the Einstein action. So we will have a short review of this Einstein action. But we have to change to a different action, which is known as first order action. And to this end, we have to cover a certain amount of theory. And the reason is that it's the first order, and the first order formulation is much easier to quantize 3D gravity and actually also 4D gravity. And basically, the modern, I think more or less all modern approaches are based on one version of first order action or another version. There are actually several versions of these first order actions. Then we will discuss symmetries of this action, and this will be basically one of the main themes, because everything will be to take care about taking proper care of these symmetries, and in this case, they are gauge symmetries. And in fact, these gauge symmetries are the reason why we, to understand quantum gravity, we basically have to solve the theory. We do a canonical analysis. Of this action, which means that we basically express the covariant equation into something like initial value equations. And one important aspect which follows from gauge symmetries is that the equation of motions come in a particular form, and they split into constraints and what one could call proper equation of motions. And in fact, the solution of the constraints is what in the quantum dynamics gives us the solutions of the theory. So this will happening more or less all in the classical domain. And mostly, again, is to just introduce these concepts, gauge symmetries, constraints, and so on. And we then can go on to quantization. And there will be a quantum geometry. And in this context, what will happen is that we will first basically represent the geometry of edges. These edges will be glued to triangles. So that means that we have a quantum representation of triangles. And these are actually glued via imposition of these constraints, part of these constraints to triangles. And then we have another, the remaining constraints. And these give us actually tetrahedra. And basically, the tetrahedra can be taken as building blocks for more complicated 3D space-time. So that will turn out to be a very nice geometrical picture. And it looks a bit discrete. And the reason that this is discrete is actually that, in fact, we are dealing with a topological quantum field theory here. And depending on time, I will give an outlook on 4D, and that will be basically mostly what happens if you don't have a TQ of T, which of course will be much harder than having a Q of T around. Okay, questions so far? So the first point seems to be these action principles. And so, as I hope you have learned, is basically that the actions are one of the most used tools to also quantize the theory. And it defines us the basic fields which we need to quantize at some point. In the path integral, it defines us amplitudes. Not uniquely defines that, but it gives us a hint on how to construct the amplitudes. And it gives us also the symmetries we need to care about. Now you probably, I mean, typically you learn this is electrodynamics is defined by this action, but in fact there are many choices of different actions which describe the same theory. And we will use that. Let us first basically consider the Einstein action. The Einstein-Hilbert action. Somebody. And it gives us a first thing, what are the fundamental fields in our theory? There's the coupling constant, which will be 1, and I guess all what follows. There's the Ricci scala, and we have the square root of the determinant of our space-time matrix, and this is integrated over four-dimensional space-time. And of course, actually, it will turn out that we can take here any space-time we want, any dimension we want. So we can define this action for any space-time dimension. what do I take as dynamic? So here, this action depends on the metric field, and this would be supposedly our fundamental field. Actually, it turns out to be slightly convenient for the following to consider the inverse metric. And we should usually think, at least in classical theory, is completely equivalent to choose one or the other. Of course, in quantum theory, there are many subtleties with choosing one over the other, but let's not comment on this at the moment. So we have to consider this as a functional on these metric fields, inverse metric fields. And then, as you should know, we find the classical equation of motion by varying our action. So let's vary our action. So kappa is 1. We have to vary 2 terms. Ricci scalar is given by the contraction of our Ricci tensor with the inverse metric. So from this variation, basically that this variation is a derivative where the Leibniz rule holds. So we can just vary each term here, and we get these 3 terms. And so there's a lengthy calculation, which I think Ruth has done, which basically shows you that this term is a total derivative. And it uses a trick, so that is, I'm not sure, it's in the script, but it might be also in the tutorials, that in fact, this turns out to be a total derivative. Which means what? It vanishes. In fact, it vanishes if you choose the right boundary conditions, which we will not discuss. Of course, there's lots of, again, there's a not very nice theory about boundary conditions, and here we will assume that we don't have a boundary. So in case one has a boundary, one, of course, should choose everything so that this indeed vanishes. And that means usually to add boundary terms also and to specify the decay behavior at an infinity or at this boundary. Okay, so that is basically the most complicated term. This term is already there. We have R menu, so it's already almost there. And in fact, we already can see the equations of motion, or at least we see that if R menu is zero, then this thing is zero and the variation vanishes. So it could, of course, happen that something non-trivial happens if we include this variation. But it will turn out that there's nothing which happens. So there's this usual trick in, okay. So I'm not sure. It depends on whether you have seen that already, then this calculation is completely boring, or whether you have not seen it, then it might be slightly mysterious. this is what the variation of the square root of the determinant of the metric gives you. So 1/2 comes from the square root. I mean, this term comes just from the square root because that's just the variation of the determinant. And this determinant is usually expressed in terms of the matrix itself. And so here we get a minus sign because we actually vary with respect to the inverse matrix. And then what comes into what happens here is that there's a formula where I hope it's correct, you can connect the variation of the determinant to the variation of the trace of a matrix. To the trace of the variation of the matrix. okay, and one can, you know, write that explicitly in all components. But this gives us basically the two terms, and now we get R menu from this side, and here we get minus 1/2. We get here square root of G. So we will get a square root of G, which would be these two factors and this square root of G, and we get an R here, and we get a G menu here. And this has to be zero. And these are basically the usual Einstein equation, as we know them, in terms of the so-called Einstein tensor, which we won't need again. And in the case of vacuum, we can one can show that these equations are actually equivalent to the Ricci tensor itself vanishing, which you can figure out by taking the trace of this equation. and subtracting that from the initial equation, and that you see that independently this Ricci tensor has to vanish. That didn't work.
Manual.
Oh, now it vanished. Okay, so that, let me write it again. We got our R menu is equal to 0. Which you know as equations of motions and 4D. And in fact, we will consider this equation of motion in 3D. And however, in 3D, it turns out that the vanishing Ricci tensor implies that the Riemann tensor vanishes. And this has something to do with, firstly, the number of independent components you can have in three dimensions. So there are alternative ways to do that, but let's count the number of components. And so here, the Ricci tensor has to be symmetric, as far as I remember. And for R mu nu, alpha beta, we had also a number of symmetries. It actually had to be anti-symmetric in this pair and anti-symmetric in this pair. And so actually, how many anti-symmetric pairs do we have in 3D? Anti-symmetric combinations of 1, 2, 3. There was a very faint 3. 3 is correct. And in fact, I mean, you might know that Hodge duality, and you know, if you have a trivial spacetime matrix, that is, any tensor you have, and it is anti-symmetric in mu nu, in 3D. You can convert it to a tensor with just one index by taking the Levi-Civita tensor, and that you see it happens only in 3D. It's just a, and this defines basically a T tilde alpha. It's something with only three indices. And of course, you can generalize it for higher dimensions, but that means that you need more indices. And technically, it's basically also something actually on the right hand side, which defines a pseudo tensor, a pseudo vector. And this, so that means that actually you have only something like an object with two indices effectively in 3D. And these two pairs had to be symmetric. And so here we have some tensor with two symmetric indices, and here we have a tensor with two symmetric indices. So you can count or not, but it means that it has the same number of components. And actually, the Riemann tensor has an additional symmetry, which is automatically satisfied. So in fact, you can count the number of components, or you can actually deduce this result from a more explicit calculation or representation of this Riemann tensor in 3D. But it means that setting the Ricci tensor to 0, it follows that the Riemann tensor is also 0. Now, again, what does it mean? You should have learned something like the equivalence principle that more or less all spacetimes which have vanishing curvature, and the Riemann tensor knows everything about all kinds of curvatures, are basically the same, are locally flat. So one has to put in this classification that we have to care about locally flat manifolds. So locally flat manifolds solve the 3D Einstein equations. That's what we are looking for. And really, you see already the first sign of a topological field theory. We started with an action which depended on an entire field. The field had even six components. Nevertheless, in the end, I mean, it was basically diminu depending on space-time. And if you naively would expect count the number of degrees of freedom, you would say, okay, if I take a spatial slice, then at least all these metric components should give me initial values. And we will see that this expectation is quite wrong. instead, we basically get that the answer is there locally, that we have to be locally flat. And physically, it means that we cannot distinguish the manifolds by very local measurements. However, if you think about it, the first answer to this riddle is that we can represent locally flat manifolds in many ways. And so this will reproduce a certain number of degrees of freedom in your metric. And it turns basically out that it reproduces all degrees of freedom which there are in a 3D manifold satisfying the Einstein equations. So this does not preclude that there are global degrees of freedom. And these depend on the manifold, on the topology of the manifold. I mean, first, the topology of the manifold in the sense that this topology will determine the number of degrees of freedom. And degrees of freedom is also something which is actually only completely well-defined in a canonical formalism. The canonical formalism kind of always assumes that you have a decomposition of your space-time manifold into a real line, which something like time times a manifold, which is 2D. And so in fact, as an example, for a topological model for it, there's a thing which you have for breakfast. It's a bagel. Not a very good one. And in fact, you can do this exercise and build your own bagel, actually called a torus, form a flat piece of paper. By taking a piece of paper, and gluing it together in this way. And actually, if you are really talented in gluing this stuff, you will manage. It's a bit easier if you put in little triangles and allow a bit of bending these things along the edges, but it's actually possible, and you will indeed see that the torus is flat in the sense that there's indeed no, I mean, this torus, not all tori are flat, but if you do that, this will be flat. So locally, there's not really metric information. However, there's global information. And in fact, I've drawn you a special torus because I can also draw something like this piece of paper and you glue it together and it differs from this torus. And basically there's two parameters which give you insight into the global geometry, and these two parameters are basically the length of the curves or geodesics around this torus. And there are two of them, because one goes this way and the other goes this way. And so you have the first non-trivial example of global degrees of freedom in 3D. So basically the equations of motions would tell you how the lengths of these curves evolve. And luckily, like 2D is the last case where one can actually classify the topologies. So what will happen is, I mean, if you want to have more complicated cases, you can have them by gluing these donuts together. And then you will get a so-called genus N manifold, where N is the number of donuts. And this will give you more more variables. However, genus, if you go to higher genus, actually turns out that it's better to be homogeneously negatively curved. And the other case is a sphere. A sphere is a bit boring because it has 0 degrees of zero. It turns out to have 0 degrees of freedom. And actually, if you know the number which is important, or the group, the structure which is important in determining the topological degrees of freedom, is this so-called first fundamental group, which is a set of curves modulo deformations of these curves, smooth deformations of the curves into each other. And you can try, you can never deform this curve here around this donut to a zero curve. Okay, so that gives you a bit of insight into what a topological field theory is in this example. And so typically, this basically associating global data to these topological quantities, like the first fundamental group. Yeah?
Is there any reason why we should require our manifold to be orientable?
Yes, you don't want... I don't want to care about non-orientable manifolds.
Okay.
I mean, I have to check, but at some point, I mean, like, for instance, we do first order gravity, and then we introduce a triad, and this is much simpler if it is actually orientable. I mean, if you ask, is it physically sensible, then I wouldn't know an example. I mean, and then it's a question if in condensed matter you can come up with an example of a non-orientable manifold where you can define a topological quantum field theory. But probably there's literature about it. Okay. So actually something, I mean, so here you see that we start with some fields, and but in the end we will have a huge reduction of degrees of freedom. And as I tried to explain, that is mostly coming from this, from changing coordinates, or technically the diffeomorphic symmetry of our initial action. So that basically will be one of the main themes of our lecture, to understand how to handle this diffeomorphism symmetry. And something similar happens also in 4D, in the sense that there's still a huge reduction of the initial degrees of freedom. However, in this case, you are really left with two kind of field degrees of freedom, as far as we know, and we hope to measure them at some point as gravitational waves. At least that's what they promise us. And so wave-like phenomena, of course, means something. You have propagating degrees of freedom, propagating from one point to the other in your manifold. So this was basically to say that we have a topological field theory. What we do next, I promise you actions. So there will be a second action. And that will be a first order action. And so what we have to do is to introduce triads, and then later also a spin connection. And so this will actually change the basic degrees of freedom. It's also slightly more than just the field redefinition, because what we do is to introduce more degrees of freedom. So we replace our matrix, actually, by, in general, field binds, N binds, or triads, or tetrads. Apparently I write them. I use these kind of indices, I, j. Again, obviously something which you can do in any dimension. In our case, we will have so-called internal indices, which I write here with Latin indices from the I, j, k, and so on. And these internal indices are contracted with an internal matrix, which is basically the matrix of this tangent space. And we take here as the Euclidean, in our case, 3D matrix. If you want to have Lorentz signature, you just need to take the Minkowski matrix and need to care more about the position of your internal indices. In our case, it doesn't really matter where you put them. So now we can basically count degrees of freedom in say, in 3D or in any dimension. So here we have some symmetric tensor in 3D at six nutmass. Here we just have some matrix. It has three indices and one, I mean, really. This index can take three values. This index can take three values. Apparently, it's 9 degrees of freedom. So somehow we switch from 6 degrees of freedom to 9 degrees of freedom. And what that means is that we have introduced kind of irrelevant information on this right-hand side compared to which does not basically go to the left-hand side. And in fact, As you probably also should have learned, that these core triads are, or actually these are triads, and the other things are core triads, can be understood as little frames that you put into a space-time. And these little frames are used to compute the length of vectors at this point. And this frame has to be orthogonal. That's basically what this conical delta here means, or the Euclidean metric. However, as you know, you can rotate an orthogonal frame and will still stay orthogonal. So actually, if you decide to change your frame by rotation, I hope I'm consistently so introduce a new frame E prime, and it's easy to check that this doesn't change your metric. And notice that you can do that at any point in your spacetime. So basically, we have, in this case, again, like a tensor field or a rotation, a choice of rotation at every point, which we can freely choose and which should not affect the matrix. And everything which is of interest is in this matrix. That is another example of a gauge symmetry in addition to our diffeomorphism symmetry. And as I told you, it's an SO3 symmetry. And in fact, more or less in quantum theory, will turn out to be an SU2 symmetry. Also, that's up to your choice in these cases, whether you choose SO3 or SU2. And so you see basically the reason after a couple of lectures, maybe not too many, we will basically reformulate gravity as a gauge theory. And this, in this case, it's an SU2 gauge theory. And so the variables we will end up with are exactly the same as in Young-Mills. And so I could skip some lectures, but we will nevertheless go through some material. So we will have an SU2 gauge theory. And again, what have we done classically? We have replaced our metric with more variables, these triads, and basically define something like the square roots of this metric. Now the question is, why should we do it? I mean, I give you now some other reasons why should one do that, and what should one keep in mind? So the problem in defining quantizing G-menu, and so far, as I told you, I don't really know a mathematical rigorous quantization which is based on this metric. And the reason is that, at least in this Euclidean space-time, what do you want the metric to be? In a positive definite space-time? Maybe positive definite? OK, so, something you have to make sense out of. Jimmy Nu is at least positive semi-definite. Also, the semi-definite already would make you lots of problems. And actually, you see already one that this is a problem for the following reason. Usually, you would assume that this matrix is actually not the space-time matrix, but it's a similar, turns out to be the spatial matrix. That will have, I think, these indices at some point. But usually, we work in quantization. If we do canonical quantization, we have canonically conjugated momenta to this matrix. And that usually means that here we have some combination of conical deltas. And since the matrix is symmetric, there's some symmetrization going on and so on. It just means that you have x, p, which is just a more complicated version of x and p, giving you 1 in the Poisson bracket. And this means that you should, you know, that typically that's why we quantize p as a derivative operator, because in quantum theory, the commutation of a derivative operator with x gives us indeed 1. This is multiplication operator. But that also means that if you want this to be, you know, mathematically a nice operator, which means that it's self-adjoint operator, it means also that we can actually exponentiate this operator. If you exponentiate the derivative operator, you get what? You get the translation operator. And this translation operator translates the values of x. But it translates it all over place. And so it translates also to negative x, of course. And to basically represent, to quantize this thing such that x is actually positive is mathematically non-trivial. We have to think about this deeply. This, of course, is more complicated. And that is one of the underlying reasons why it's difficult to quantize that. It's actually related to the question why there's no quantum representation for the operator of time. It's kind of similar. If you want to have a positive Hamiltonian, and the Hamiltonian is conjugated to a time, that makes this question kind of difficult. There's a solution which, there's an approach which is called affine quantum gravity, where you replace this thing by another thing, which basically rather you replace these operators, which would generate translations, by something which generates a dilatation, because that would be always positive. That would keep positivity. And that's called affine quantum gravity. And as far as I know, it's not done by a huge amount of people. So that's the reason why this is more convenient, because automatically for any choice here, if you kind of take this combination, you would believe that there's something more positive than just looking at G mu nu. However, even classically, if you say this should be even positive, which you would like to be, because you might not know what it means if you have a degenerate matrix. Here, if you don't put any conditions, this choice of any choice of triad can give you any degenerate matrix. And so here is one of these many questions which is not completely settled, even in 3D gravity, but less so in 4D gravity. You have to decide what space of configurations you want to quantize. And so here, especially, do you try to to quantize a space of non-degenerate matrix or non-degenerate geometries. You can try. It's usually very hard because it's not a manifold. I mean, apart from being infinite dimensional, it will not be a manifold at all. Or do you don't care and quantize something which also includes all kind of non-degenerate degenerate matrix? Actually, this version turns out to be at least more convenient. I mean, it's unclear whether it's the truth, but it's more convenient. Also, as you will see, that time is one of these things which is up to choice. And here, it will also turn out that something like the direction of time is up to choice. And that can be argued as, again, to having this relation where basically choosing both things, both time directions negative, doesn't matter here. So here we will get a more symmetric representation of the quantum theory with respect to time reversal. And actually, the quantum theory will have basically always a combination of amplitudes, cosine of the action, instead of the exponential of the action, with plus y and minus y. Okay, and so I think in the next lecture, yeah, we will go more through technical stuff in these triads, which is just that. Okay, we can basically move the indices around, and that will define us different versions of these triads. And what we have to define is a spin connection, which is a connection which is compatible with a matrix and with this choice of triads, so that we can basically translate everything which you learned with a Levi-Civita connection to also working with the triads. And having these two variables, so these will be turn out to be our basic variables. So before we just had the matrix. Now we have the triads and the spin connection. The spin connection will be a free variable in the action. But in fact, if you really want to have it matrix compatible, it is expressed as a derivative of the first of the triads. So that can be compared to phi dot is equal to pi. So basically, you introduce additional variables, which are derivatives of your initial variables, and treat them as free variables. So introduce even more variables. But what happens is that the equation of motions, in fact, determine that p is equal to phi dot. So in this case, they will, in fact, determine that this connection, I mean, it's actually a connection, is really this spin connection. Of course, in language, it will happen that I will just say the spin connection, and that means just connection. and for this reason, it's called first order, because the equations of motions for these first order actions are first order, which just means that they're automatically almost in a Hamiltonian form, which is the reason why, another reason why we do this, why we use these first order actions, because it will almost trivialize, in this case in 3D, our canonical analysis. It's almost, will be automatically there, basically. Okay, are there questions?
So, about 2 plus 1 gravity in the metric formulation. So, Carlos' book, you find half of it is just how we do it using the metric representation of quantization.
Yeah.
So, you might just write down the seemingly well defined half integral of everything. So, how do you use it? Because
yeah, I would have to check. You can write it really in the metric.
Right.
I mean, in the metric representation with the pass integral. I mean, you could probably reconstruct everything from the solution.
But, I mean, he uses the moduli that take
the moduli. Yeah, he basically reduces. So, what he does, he first reduces. And I'm not going through this because I'm not so much keen on this special feature of 3D. And first reducing is only available in this case where you actually can reduce. And for 4D, It would be nice if we could, but of course we can't. So because we can't, we have to go through this working with the full space and then trying to deal with it in quantum theory. Of course, it's a bit cheating saying, ah, we can't do it. Let's do it in quantum theory. So to introduce the techniques which will be relevant in 4D, we don't reduce first. So we could actually take this stuff and just introduce this reduced, basically find a parametrization of the space of solutions, which would give us a nice parametrization one-to-one with the solutions, and basically quantize the space. And that is called a reduced phase-space quantization, or reduced quantization, or whatever you want. And even in the simpler systems, it might be sometimes complicated, because the phase space you get is, again, it's similar to this example. It might not be a manifold, might not be just R2, but might be funny orbifold or funny boundaries and so on. And in fact, there's lots of mathematical literature which is very nice and does this. If you Google Teichmüller space and all these things, that is basically about these approaches. Okay, thank you.